Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Finance officials from around the world came together for a big G20 meeting this weekend south of London. While they debated economic stimulus and global regulation, the U.S. blew up over millions in bonuses paid at AIG. Once a global Wall Street power itself, now a bailout beggar. From Main Street to Wall Street to London, Paris, and Beijing, everybody's talking about a global crisis. This hour, On Point, from AIG to the G20, the unfinished turmoil in global banking and finance. You can join the conversation. Will America's cowboy capitalism survive the global meltdown? Will European-style regulation let the economy come back? And what about those bonuses at AIG? Joining me first today from London is Chris Giles, economics editor at the Financial Times. He covered the G20 meeting in Horsham, UK, over the weekend. Chris Giles, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
What did they set out to do? Did they succeed?
Well, the G20 set out last November really to do two big things. One is to get us out of this big mess that the whole world is now in, the recession and the economic and financial crisis. And the second thing is to stop it ever happening again by trying to draw up internationally agreed standards of financial regulation. And no, I think, is the answer. They didn't really achieve either of those two things. On the first, at least they stopped arguing. There had been a large transatlantic row in the preceding week where America was accusing the Europeans essentially of not doing enough to stimulate the European economy, not cutting taxes fast enough and not increasing public spending fast enough, as the new Obama administration has done in the US. And the Europeans, on their terms, using different definitions, were basically saying, yes, we are doing just as much, and two, we must remember about regulation, and it's actually hedge funds and tax havens and things like that which is more important. And so there's a great difference of emphasis. And though all of these differences were sort of patched up or the cracks were papered over at the weekend, really very little else happened. There wasn't any big thing to take away to say that the world has now got a better plan of how to either get out of the mess or stop it happening again.
Chris, these 20 nations account for something like 85-90% of global GDP. They've got enormous clout. And of course, they're prepping here, finance ministers and officials, for heads of state who will meet in London very early in April, including Barack Obama, his first big trip abroad after Canada. The markets around the world today seem to be responding positively to whatever did or didn't happen at the G20. Are people waiting for, you know, one big thunderclap solution to come out of this global body?
Well, I hope they're not waiting for a big thunderclap solution, because that's clearly not going to happen. I think we will get some useful agreements in London in April, partly because it seems pretty clear that some things have already essentially been agreed, but they've been sort of banked by the finance ministers. They weren't announced at the weekend just to give the leaders something that they knew they'd be able to announce. And the most important of that is there looks like a deal done to give the International Monetary Fund a large increase in resources. Now, that might seem quite esoteric, but the reason that's important is because the last thing any country in the world needs, rich countries or poor countries, is for this crisis to spread very quickly through Eastern Europe, through Latin America, where countries have much fewer resources to deal with it on their own account. And that's where you need a big global body to be able to step in and to stop this contagion happening, so that the crisis keeps rolling on and on and on, and then coming back to hit the rich countries in the end. And so I think that deal will be done. But apart from that, it's very unlikely we'll see any sort of big statement, or any countries actually having to go home from London on the 2nd of April, actually having to change their policies of things they were already going to do.
Now, your Prime Minister in the UK, Gordon Brown, however, has still been talking big. He said just in the last few days, you're going to see a massive change in the supervisory system, that is, global regulation of finance. Is there an indication that that's afoot? And are the U.S. and the U.K., which have been called the Anglo-Saxon casino by the Europeans, are they on board with what Paris and with what the French and Germans want?
I think in time there will certainly be a big change in financial regulations. I don't think there's any country who thinks that the previous financial regulations worked or are appropriate for the future. And there's, in the US they don't, in UK they don't, and certainly they don't in Paris and in Berlin. And the one area where everyone is agreed needs to change, although this will take a long time, is that banks in particular need to build up much greater buffers in good times so that they have a bigger cushion that they can use up in bad times and they don't suddenly collapse so quickly, spreading the crisis. And so we will see banks in future being far less profitable in good times than they were in the past, because they won't be able to keep lending at the rate at which they were, because the regulations, both domestic regulations and probably some minimum standards internationally, will stop them doing that. But this will take quite a long time, and it certainly won't come out of the London agreement. Well, London might well say that this is an ambition, and that was in the finance minister's statement. It was an ambition to stop financial regulations amplifying the already existing economic cycle, and it wants to try and dampen it. But there's a lot of detail to go out, because the moment these things always get terribly complicated when you get into the detail, and that's when countries often start saying, no, actually, I don't like that bit.
And I wonder about how the news of these large bonuses at AIG on Wall Street hit the UK and Europe. There's a sort of firestorm of popularist anger over it in the United States. But what about in European trading centers, capitals? How do people see what goes on with bonuses in this country even now?
Well, I think the bonus issue has been huge in Europe, just as large, but more. It normally seems to be happening with your own bank. So in the UK, it's the bonuses at Royal Bank of Scotland and the pension for the former chief executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is a bank that the government now owns, well, will own getting on for 95% of, because it was going to collapse last October. It's bonuses paid in those organisations that have been the real flashpoint. And while we see the AIG bonus issue as interesting, because it's exactly the same issue that's happened happening in the US right now as what has happened in the UK over some other banks, it's very much seen as, look, the US is actually quite similar to us, and they're having the same argument over sort of unfair gains to the people who got us into the mess as we've been having here.
Chris Giles with the Financial Times. Stand by in London for a moment. I have with me in the studio here in Boston someone who you know, I think, Kenneth Rogoff, professor of public policy and economics at Harvard University, chief economist and director of research at the IMF International Monetary Fund until 2003. Professor Rogoff, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We've got Chris Giles in London reporting on the G20. Let me ask you, do you see an entire style of finance, maybe even of capitalism, going out the window here between, you know, the global upset and Europe really unhappy about it, and everybody saying there wasn't enough regulation? Are we into a phase change here?
Oh, we're certainly into a sea change. The question is, what's happening and when? I think Chris rightly said that the change in the financial regulation, the new financial regulation, is complicated. It's going to take time. But I'm disappointed that they're not moving on it faster, because we have a big mess. We have to sort it out. But how can we do it if we don't know where we're going, if we don't know where we want to be in 4 or 5 years? And as long as they're fighting about that, it's very hard to get a work out of the financial crisis, which is really what's dragging down the economy right now.
And by implication, you're saying there, that can only today, these days, be accomplished by this group, not simply by Washington or London. No one power can say, here's where we're headed.
Absolutely. We need some kind of global coordination. There's a question of how far, but I mean, the fact is capital flows freely across borders. And if the United States and Britain have a lot lighter standards, if we're the easy place to go, no regulation, that's where all the money goes. I think the Europeans are right to be furious about it. We were making tons of money, putting the whole world at risk, and now the whole world's paying the price.
So if the goal hasn't been set, if it hasn't been articulated, put down on paper, is that a failure of the G20 meeting in Horsham this weekend?
Well, I mean, it depends on your expectations. I've sat in on the deputy meetings for these, and they're pretty, you know, huge and unwieldy. And I think if you haven't agreed something, you know, in advance, it's a little much to expect it. But I think it's a broader failure of the leadership in the world at the moment. I mean, we're just swimming in this thing.
Chris Giles, did you have a sense of urgency in the hall there to get something together? You say it may take years, but, you know, things have been falling apart by the day, the week.
I think there's an urgency to do something, but there's quite a lot of disagreement about the detail. And you can see this in the communiques. So while you'll get very bland statements saying we must make the financial regulation act against the economic cycle, or we must regulate systemically important financial companies, then they were, the finance ministers were actually tasked with defining what they thought was a systemically important company. That's a company that could bring down other companies and then have a knock-on effect. But again, in the communique, again, they just come up with the same phrase that they will regulate in future much more carefully and have much greater oversight of systemically important companies. Now, we know very much that Germany, for example, wants to have much bigger oversight of all hedge funds, and Britain in particular, because lots of hedge funds actually live in London, where regulation has been much lighter, is much more wary and would want to have a very narrow definition of what was the size and type of hedge fund that needed much bigger international regulation. And so there are all these international games, as Ken was just talking about, which are actually sort of putting sand into the works. And he's absolutely right. Unless you get people really being very clear on what is and what isn't going to be permitted. In a broad sense, it's going to be very hard to see us getting out of this.
Chris Giles, economics editor at the Financial Times, who was in Horsham, UK, over the weekend at the G20 meeting. Mr. Giles, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the G20 meeting, fury over AIG bonuses, and the global battle over reshaping banking and finance. I'm joined in the studio today by the former chief economist and director of research at the International Monetary Fund, now professor of economics at Harvard University, Kenneth Rogoff, and with us now from Washington, D.C., Ishwar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, formerly at the IMF, himself. Ishwar Prasad, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I want to hear straight from our listeners, because they've got a lot to say about AIG, and I want to hear what you and Ken Rogoff have to say in response. Bob, in Iowa City, Iowa. Bob, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'm just surprised that the money has to be going somewhere, you know, and why isn't anybody backtracking this money, and why isn't anybody in jail?
Which money exactly, Bob?
Pardon me?
Which money exactly, sir?
Well, the money the American people are, you know, financing their operation with. It's like legalized robbery without a gun.
Talking about AIG and their bonuses, or where they've been shipping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thieves in suits. You know, I mean, what? You know, how can you be rewarded, you know, for doing something unsuccessfully? The American public is just being completely robbed.
Legalized robbery without a gun. We'll pick it up. Economists Ken and Ishwar. Ken Rogoff, first to you. This is a very common attitude right here.
You know, it's hard not to agree. I mean, except for legal niceties about, you know, exactly technically where did they break the law and not. We've put $163 billion into AIG, and it's not just the AIG bonuses, the $165 million that got paid out this weekend to these people who lost all this money, but AIG also just revealed where these payouts have been going, and they've been going to big financial firms all over the world, in the United States, places like Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. Bank America, Citibank.
In Europe,
Barclays, Credit mm-hmm. Suisse, UBS. And, you know, we're talking $10 and $12 billion to many of these.
Mm-hmm.
And it pays—
At a chunk.
And mm-hmm. it's paying their bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just AIG. This is money just being basically shoveled to the world's financial sector.
I wonder if it's not just the bonuses, Ishwar Prasad, but the whole business that AIG was in here. You were talking Goldman Sachs and Barclays. These are very sophisticated outfits. They had investments insured through these credit default swaps. I mean, were they in effect gambling themselves that if AIG had problems, that the American taxpayer would have to bail them out? That does sound like legalized robbery.
Tom, that implicit bailout that was always there in the background certainly did not help. But ultimately, what we are seeing is that the financial system was built on a house of cards. And this house of cards was sustained by two or three factors, of course. One was the incentives that the investment managers had to take on very large risks without being exposed themselves to the downside risks that they faced. The second, of course, was that there were some problems with the regulatory system, which we are beginning to learn about now. There were parts of the financial system that were not well regulated, and we thought this wouldn't infect those parts of the regulatory system, of the financial system that were, in fact, we thought, reasonably well regulated, like the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're learning, of course, is that those are connected. And the third part, of course, is that there is an international dimension to it, because one of the factors that led to this not just being a bubble in the United States that popped, but as Professor Rogoff pointed out, ended up in a cataclysm that has engulfed economies around the globe, is that there were macroeconomic imbalances around the world. And Professor Rogoff himself has written extensively about these. Mm-hmm. You did have conditions for excessive consumption in the United States. It was fueled by excessive savings in China. So ultimately, this is where the G20 process becomes very important, because we cannot fix the financial system problems and hope that these crises will not happen again in the future, unless
but
we
of course
solve the macroeconomic part as well.
But you also can't solve it just at macro terms if you've got people down in the engine room kind of gaming the system on a massive, massive scale. Let's go to Bernard in Boston. Boston, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Bernard. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to understand what this $85 billion that AIG shoveled out to all these banks really was, because there are credit default swaps that are insurance for loans that go bad.
Right.
There are credit default swaps that are just gambling based on what somebody else is going to do, and there's hundreds of trillions of those out. And then did AIG have to pay because loans went bad, or did AIG have to pay because AIG went bad and they had to cover even though the loans were still good?
Ken Rogoff, take us into this. Credit default swaps are insuring against losses. There may be different flavors of them, but you hear Bernard's question. What were the flavors at work here? Why so much?
Well, most of the big investment banks and the big players were hedging their bets, sort of like a bookie. They take the bets on one side and the offsetting bets on the other side. The problem at AIG is they didn't hedge anything. They just thought they're writing plain vanilla insurance policies, like they write life insurance or insuring your home. They look at how often homes burn down, how, you know, often do people of a certain age die. They do some calculations, and they looked at these credit default swaps just like they were a regular old insurance policy.
But in effect, they were hedging with taxpayer wallets against this, right? As it turns out.
I mean, the regulation system never, ever should have allowed that. I mean, so the AIG, I believe, mm-hmm. just didn't understand. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine.
But that's a benign interpretation. I mean, these are a lot of smart people across many companies here. They really didn't know what they were in the midst of. You had Warren Buffett saying years ago, this is a giant, dangerous, atomic casino.
Well, I don't want to be too benign. I agreed with the earlier listener that it's hard not to see these people put in jail. I mean, you accidentally run somebody over with a car and you can give it a benign interpretation, but, you know, you go to jail for it. We're talking about the American taxpayer, I think, actually ultimately losing trillions of dollars from what this is, you know, has happened.
Ishwar, do you see, could this have been deliberately played, or was this beyond everybody's comprehension, how this would unfold?
At a time when the going was good, Tom, it was very difficult for some of these people to stay on the sidelines and see their competitors make large sums of money. So it was the natural temptation. But the temptation was fueled by very weak regulation. And ultimately, that is where part of the solution has to come from, because it is good to have relatively unfettered finance and financial innovation so long as there is a framework for making sure that things don't get out of hand. And in this case, the sort of bets that were taken by many of these financial firms, including AIG, were based on assumptions that came from relatively good times. And as Ken pointed out, AIG did not seem to have a good handle on what exactly it was insuring. The complexity of these financial products is another issue. There is this notion that people on Wall Street are very, very smart, have all this figured out, and therefore they are protecting themselves. I'm a little less sure, because these products had become extremely complex, and it was very difficult for even one firm like Goldman Sachs to see all the assets and liabilities on its balance sheet and get a good sense of how much risk it was facing. Plus, all the interconnections among these different big players created further problems, because as we saw from the case of Lehman's collapse, when one big firm went under, the sort of risks that were in the system suddenly became much, much greater, because there was this notion of counterparty risk, where if one firm fails, essentially the risks on your books become that much greater. So I don't think this is all that well thought out, either by the banks themselves or by the regulatory system. And when the going was good, the executives had good incentives to continue playing the game and to make large sums of money. So in terms of the compensation schemes for the executives and in terms of the regulatory system, I think a great deal needs to be rethought and reworked to make sure this doesn't happen again.
And now the guys who are exactly in the units who were operating exactly these failures are some of those who are getting big bonuses. Here's Lawrence Summers, President Obama's top economic advisor on ABC's This Week yesterday, saying it was outrageous, but there's a legal framework. They can't get around the responsibility.
There are a lot of terrible things that have happened in the last 18 months, but what's happened at AIG is the most outrageous. What that company did, the way it was not regulated, the way no one was watching, what's proved necessary. It is outrageous. We are a country of law. There are contracts. The government cannot just abrogate contracts. Every legal step possible to limit those bonuses is being taken.
Every legal step possible. I want to hear from you all on this, but let me go to Randall first in Nashville, Tennessee. Randall, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just would like to hear some comment about the moral and ethical situation that we as a society have gotten ourselves into. We as consumers, and I'm a middle-class, self-employed person, it seems like the only choice that I have is to be a diligent consumer and put my money where I know that ethical, moral choices are going to be made. I look at the current capital situation, and it's caveat emptor, right? Buyer beware.
Yep.
And unless we make choices as consumers, then we just allow ourselves to continue to be victims.
But Randall, you and others in your situation were told for years, if you don't have your money in that market, you'll never be able to retire. You'll never be able. You've got to be in there to be part of the American system economy.
Well, we can allow ourselves to be, to live in fear, or we can make choices where we protect ourselves and have a security that's outside of that way of thinking. So,
and maybe some collective choices required to have the leverage to bring a little more security to that situation. Kenneth Rogoff, between what's going on in Washington and the kind of noises coming out of the G20, do you see the powers that be girding to really take on the problem we're facing here?
I think they're like deer caught in the headlights.
Even now?
Oh, absolutely. They can't get their heads wrapped around the scale of the problem, the trillions of dollars that's going to cost. I want to make a comment back on the moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the run-up to this, not just the AIG bonuses this weekend, but the run-up, these people in the financial sector were making these profits, these bonuses that were just unimaginable. $100 million didn't even make you rich anymore. And they said, well, we're doing great things. We're creating financial globalization. But in fact, they were taking huge risks that ultimately were footing the bill for.
But it wasn't just inside their boiler room. I remember on this show a couple of summers back when those bonuses were roaring so high, saying to very learned economists, academics, this looks to me like this could drive the American economy right off a cliff, take us to a collapse. I put that to economists and they came back and said, no, these were experts in finance saying, no, this is part of the American advantage. This is our expertise, our extreme sophistication at work here, efficiencies like we've never seen before.
Well, I'm afraid finance economists in particular really drank the Kool-Aid that we had discovered this perpetual motion, perpetual money machine, maybe is more exact, and our creativity was leading to all this and not understanding that a lot of it was plain vanilla risk. As Iswar said earlier, there were these imbalances in the global economy, the massive U.S. borrowing from abroad, hundreds of billions of dollars year after year, housing prices doubling in 5 years, consumers borrowing credit cards up to their teeth. It should have been clear that there was a problem here.
Should have been clear, but even when the question was put, comforting words, but no action to get things in order. Let's get a call from Joan in Brattleboro, Vermont. Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I gather you're interested because I used to work for AIG.
Okay.
It wasn't for very long. It was for a couple of years, and it was 20 years ago now in New York City.
Okay.
One thing I've wondered about hearing all of this now is I was writing for AIU, which is AIG is a holding company, basically,
right,
which owns a whole bunch of other companies, which do the actual writing of insurance.
Yep.
I doubt that there's anybody that has an AIG insurance policy, per se. And AIU was the overseas business insurance company, which is what I worked for out of New York.
Okay.
And, but every... I don't know if it was every cent exactly, but a great percentage, the highest percentage possible of any insurance policy we wrote, as we were writing it, we had to establish reinsurance for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard anyone in this whole conversation anywhere mention reinsurance.
So in the time when you were doing this kind of work, Joan, did you feel like a scoundrel? Did you feel like you were skating on the edge of catastrophe, or you were...
Oh, no, well, we weren't. I mean, I wasn't doing anything like what you're talking about
right
now.
Right.
I was doing regular insurance, like
right
anybody ever has written regular insurance. It just happened to be for companies that were overseas.
Let's pick it up. Iswar Prasad, did something change? Clearly something must have changed in those 20 years because there's no backing for a lot of this. It was just, it was hanging out there at risk.
Let me first make one point about the financial system, Tom. I certainly don't want to come across as an apologist for what has happened because what has happened is indeed, as Summers put it, outrageous, but the financial system has become the lifeblood of modern economies, and it does play an important role. What happened in the U.S. essentially is that there were very large rewards to innovation that went beyond what might be arguably necessary for financial intermediation, that is for savings to be transferred into productive investment. That needs to be done for an economy to work well and be productive. But here, we went well beyond that into a situation where we had lots of derivative products, which includes a sort of reinsurance your caller was talking about, and other types of financial innovations that were really more about making money than about allocating capital more efficiently. So that was the real problem. And there again, the concern was that AIG and other firms in their position did not have a decent enough assessment of the risks, and there was nobody out there to force them to take a clear perspective of these risks on their entire balance sheet. And my sense is that much of this insurance and reinsurance activity did in fact get treated the same way that life insurance and other products had been treated. But of course, the game had changed. You did have much more complicated instruments. And given that there was no clear regulation, it was very easy for people to take very large bets that paid off when times were good. And when times were not going to be good, that was something that people preferred not to think about because then, as Ken pointed out, you just weren't making as much money as your competitor. So there is a fundamental rot in the financial system that needs to be sorted out. But on the moral side, we should also note that many of us have been willing participants in this because nobody forced people to take mortgages that were well beyond their ability to borrow based on their incomes. But the financial system did facilitate it. And many of us did think that the government was ultimately going to take care of everything or was keeping an eye on things. And the problem was that the government was not keeping an eye on everything. And ultimately, we as individuals have a role in this as well as monitoring what our financial system is doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the G20 meeting, about fury over AIG bonuses, and the global battle over reshaping banking and finance. Kenneth Rogoff has joined us this hour, professor of public policy and economics at Harvard University, former chief economist and director of research at the International Monetary Fund. With us from Washington, Iswar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, also worked at the IMF for 16 years, part of that time as head of the Financial Studies Division and the China Division. So he's seen a lot. They both have. Lots of talk out of high officials in the Obama administration over the weekend. Benjamin Bernanke, head of the Fed, in a rare interview, was on 60 Minutes with Scott Pelley on Sunday. He predicted America's recession would end this year.
We do have a plan. We're working on it. And I do think that we will get it stabilized, and we'll see the recession coming to an end probably this year. We'll see recovery beginning next year, and it'll pick up steam over time.
You think the recession is going to end this year?
In the sense that this decline will begin to moderate and we'll begin to see leveling off. Now, we won't be back to full employment, but we will see, I hope, the end of these declines that have been so strong in the last couple quarters.
We hope he's right. Timothy Geithner was at the G20 meeting in Horsham, England. On Saturday, he sounded a hopeful note on the world's ability to come together and address the economic crisis.
You are seeing the world move together at a speed and on a scale without precedent in modern times. All the major economies are putting in place substantial fiscal packages. The stronger the response, the quicker recovery will come.
The stronger the response, the quicker the recovery will come. Let's get a call from Toronto and Joan. Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, America.
Hello, Canada.
From your best friends.
Great. What do you see, Joan?
Well, we're all, really, everybody in the world, not just Americans, are caught up in this ball of wax.
No kidding.
And one of the things that really troubles me that you aren't discussing on this program is what this means for, you know, our kids, our grandkids, our schools, our hospitals 15, 20 years into the future, not to mention the developing world. It's, you know, where in many places where people are barely surviving now, $165 billion to a few people, it's a million.
Which should make you feel better, but it's still a lot of money, and there may be more.
So my question is, for your panelists, you know, the little people are supposed to be making the moral choices. Who's representing the little people at the G20? Because I don't see it.
Iswar Prasad, let me bring that first to you. The moral choices of ordinary people, are they at the table in Horsham? Will they be there in London when all the heads of state get together? Is this now of such a scale, a calamity, that, you know, the moral voice will out here?
At one level, the fact that it is a G20 meeting rather than the G7 meeting in order to try to pull the world together is important enough, because many middle-income countries are represented there, countries like China and India, which do have many people below the poverty line. But it's true that the really low-income countries are not part of this a confabulation. But the real issue is that the best way to help the low-income countries is not just have them have a seat at the table, but for these big economies, the big industrial countries, as well as countries like China and India, to get their act together and start growing again and be able to absorb imports from the rest of the world and stop exporting financial instability to the rest of the world. In that sense, the U.S. definitely needs to play a role in terms of bringing these countries together. But the problem, of course, is that the U.S. has lost some of its aura of moral leadership. One concrete thing that did come out of the G20 meetings was the notion of increasing support for the International Monetary Fund, which is really critical in terms of making sure that many low-income countries and emerging markets that are at the brink don't go over the brink. And that is actually a very important role that the G20 is playing, trying to provide quick financing to the IMF. But ultimately, this is a solution that is going to require global cooperation, because the scope has now expanded so much that it's going to be difficult for one country to solve it by itself.
Ken Rogoff, I'm looking here still at the front page of the Financial Times, and it's talking about nations explore alternatives to the Anglo-Saxon casino, quote-unquote casino. Is there a widely understood to be a cultural element here to what happened with international finance? Does Europe have a model that's different? What about India and China? Is China really going to go for a stronger international regime of regulation?
Well, there's a cultural and also, I'd say, a legal element to this. The United States and Britain sort of believe that you should try to have the minimal amount of regulation, allow these guys to be creative, move money around the economy to make it more productive, to diversify risk.
To get that innovation and efficient allocation of capital Ishwar was talking about.
And we thought we had it right. And I remember when a couple years ago, the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, dared to say, why don't we have the hedge funds and the investment banks be a little more forthcoming in information? And she just got killed by George Bush, Gordon Brown, Paulson, our Treasury Secretary.
The markets will take care of this.
They'll regulate themselves. Don't get in the way. There was this angry commission that Paulson chaired to just try to dump on the Germans. Absolutely, we're headed towards a model with more regulation. We had the least. Europe after that. India and China have a ton of regulation.
China? Really?
Their financial system's virtually dysfunctional. Ishwar is quite an expert on it, but no, they have tremendous repression. I mean, so there's a balance. You want the creativity, the dynamism, but you don't just want to be handing out a blank check. You have to be watching. We were asleep while this was happening. And I think the biggest blame lies with our regulators, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the Treasury secretaries, the Securities and Exchange Commission. They told us everything was fine. There were some of us who didn't believe it, but they were very insistent. They were really the ones who did not represent our interests properly.
Ishwar, if a new sort of global order is going to be established around regulation then, who's the final little small table? You know, these things don't happen in giant committee meetings. Where is this going to be decided? Who will have the greatest say in that? Has the United States lost so much moral authority that it's on the sidelines? Is Europe going to drive this? Are we going to have a very different kind of global economy then? Will China really sign on for this?
A lot of the discussion about the frameworks for international financial regulation take place either at the International Monetary Fund or more recently at a forum called the Financial Stability Forum. And one very concrete thing that did come out of the G20 finance ministers meeting last weekend is that the membership of the Financial Stability Forum has now been expanded to include all of the G20 countries, or at least they've agreed on that. And this is an important step because the FSF until now included just the major industrial countries and three or four of the smaller industrial countries plus Singapore and Hong Kong. So there is a recognition now that the key economies do need to have a seat at the table in terms of coming up with a better regulatory framework.
But you've said, I think, that China is pretty much against international regulation altogether.
Yes, and this is where things become interesting because there are different coalitions on different aspects. If you think about financial regulation, as Ken pointed out, the Europeans are very eager to move forward because they see weak European financial regulation as the key problem. The U.S. doesn't want to move quite as fast on this because it wants to reconsider the whole framework and the principles behind it. China and India, on the other hand, are concerned that, in fact, if an international regulatory system is set up that it does not work to their advantage, essentially you have a system that intrudes on the way they want to proceed with the regulation and development. So nothing is quite set in stone yet, but it's good that there is at least going to be a cooperative approach to this. But whether they can come up with a system that makes a lot of sense and that all the countries can sign on to is going to be interesting to see, especially because these countries are very different financial systems. China is a repressed financial system, as Ken pointed out, with all the banks already being state-owned. They have different levels of regulatory capacity. So ultimately, whether some good will come out of this is hard to tell, but the fact that they're all talking to each other, I think, is a good start.
Let's go to Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
Great show. You know, it's a riot listening to Lawrence Summers. It reminds me of the film Casablanca, where he is just outraged that this is what's been going on.
Shocked.
I am shocked that there's gambling at Casablanca. But I think the point is two things. One is to really zero in on the difference between gambling and investment. And you have to understand that who's going to regulate the regulators when the regulators are the people that are drinking the gambling Kool-Aid?
What do you mean?
Well, you got people like Robert Rubin, Hank Paulson, Lawrence Summers. These are the guys who mix the Kool-Aid. You got this revolving door between the investment community and the regulators. So why wouldn't they just keep the party going as long as people are making money? And I think what's really underneath this, that you guys really need to burrow into the real difference between speculation and gambling and investment. Because what was going on was not investment in, you know, getting capital to move productivity. These people didn't care whether these companies went up or down as long as they're making money on their speculations and their gambles.
So, Sam, those are tough and good questions. Let me hold that for just one moment and get one more here from Urbandale, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm sitting here doing a double slow burn because I'm looking at a list of the board of directors for AIG.
Okay.
One name hits me right between the eyes. Professor of Economics at Harvard University, Martin Feldstein. You have folks on your panel there today who are representing themselves as experts from Harvard University.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I think that the boards of directors from not just AIG, but all of these corporations have been remiss in their duties, and they need to tender their resignations and put people on the board who won't write contracts that pay people for poor performance.
David, that is it's a tough perspective and a legitimate one, given what we're looking at here. Let me hold that one, too, and get one more here. Thank you for your call, Dave. Michael in Ithaca, New York. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. What I want to know is what makes people think that regulation is going to do any damn good? I mean, you have regulation that was passed during the last Depression. Glass-Steagall was repealed. It's quite obvious that all the market factors, you know, these people are believe in capitalism. The market factors are inclined to make people avoid, repeal, and get around regulations.
But Michael, we've got it. On the other hand, we had many decades and we didn't have scandal and catastrophe like this. That's a lot on the table, and I thank all our callers for it. Ken Rogoff, I'll come first to you. You hear our caller Dave in Iowa saying, for heaven's sakes, your own colleagues are on the board of AIG. Buried in there is something really important. I mean, who can people trust at this point? And you heard our caller Sam say, the guys who are supposed to now design the regulation are the gamblers who mixed the Kool-Aid. What do you say?
Well, I mean, first, it's clear a lot of very smart people didn't understand what was going on in these complicated derivatives market and made terrible mistakes. By the way, I love Sam's comment about Casablanca and what do you mean there's gambling going on here. I think there's a very deep problem between regulation and our political system. These financial firms in boon times are making a lot of money, and they're giving it
oceans,
not just to regulators. Mm-hmm. They're giving it to all the political parties, the presidential candidates. Look at the list of the big donors in the primaries to the presidential candidates. They're virtually all these financial firms. Mm. And that goes into the voting process, and they pressure the regulators not to be as tough. It's all over the world. And I think you need an international regulator to be more isolated from these political pressures, and maybe they'll be more incompetent.
Who in the heck would that ever be?
A new institution. A new institution. I think absolutely we need a new institution. They may be more clumsy. They may be more clever, but they'll be more insulated. And I think the international—
But the U.S. wouldn't, barely cooperates with the U.N., and that's just politics. Here we're talking money.
Well, I mean, it's about time we had our tail between our legs. I don't think the world's going to come back to us unless we give a viable regulatory system. We have truly lost everyone's confidence.
Yeswar, can you imagine that? I don't know where this, this sainted figure would stride in from, but some new institution with somebody at its helm, international, outside Washington or London or Beijing, who would lay down the law. Moses comes down from, I don't know where. What about it, Yeswar?
If only, Tom. But I think the fundamental point is that we may be asking too much of regulation. As your third caller pointed out, there is a temptation in financial markets to get around regulation. There is a lot of money to be made by getting around regulation.
Yeah, but isn't that too nihilistic? We had decades where there was a good enough balance of regulation that we
Absolutely.
Didn't have this kind of total pileup.
And that's the critical issue, finding the right balance, because ultimately we as citizens cannot give up the entire role of monitoring to the government. If the government monitors everything and we feel that the government is capable of monitoring everything and stop paying attention to what is happening around us and take risks ourselves, that makes things a lot worse. So there has to be a good balance, and the government has a critical role to play. It has a role to play in making sure that these imbalances in the system don't build up to a level where the amount of risk between institutions and the level of institution each risk any particular institution is taking doesn't bring down the whole system. Plus, they have to make sure that there is enough transparency in the system so that we can all look at the books, or at least experts can look at the books and figure out what these firms are doing. So the government has a critical role to play, but I think ultimately it may be too much to hope that the government will solve all these problems and there'll never be a crisis, even if we did have the perfect regulatory system. We need to do a tremendous amount to make sure this doesn't happen again, but financial systems by their inherent nature are a little risky.
But what fools we are if we can't do better than this. Surely it's not bad. Our time is running down here. We're going to see more on this when the heads of state get together for the G20 April 2nd in London. So this story is by no means finished, but the phone lines are still burning up with AIG questions, Ishwar and Ken Rogoff. I mean, here, Mary says, look at the people who are losing their jobs. The bailout is already bonus enough. Paul in Keene, New York says he wants the name of every individual getting a bonus. You know, let's redirect this money to small businesses. Bill, Sudbury, Massachusetts, you know, how could they write contracts for these bonuses that had no provision in them for an environment like this, a catastrophic provision like this? Ken Rogoff, you're shaking your head at the emotion and thinking behind these questions.
Well, I think it's absolutely right. I mean, the way that bonuses were given out in the whole financial sector, these very short-term, you had a good year, no recognition of the long-term risks, was just absurd. And yes, regulation's not perfect. Yes, we are always going to have crises. But you can't have the regulators just fall asleep or even be cheerleaders, as I think some of our regulators were during this period. The government's not enough, as Ishwar said. We have to do it ourselves. Firms have to do it. But the government at least has to be there.
Listeners, you are the best watchdogs. There's no question about it. We'll try and do our part to help. I'm grateful to both of my guests this hour for helping light up the subject. Ishwar Prasad at Brookings Institute in Washington and Cornell. Ishwar, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me on, Tom, and you're absolutely right. We need to do a lot better.
Hear for that. Kenneth Rogoff, professor at Harvard, former chief economist at the IMF. You're always great at explaining what's going on here. Ken, we appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom, for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.